All right, well, thanks, Jeff, for that. I would like to start out by recognizing my co-author, Dr. Tom Brulsma. He's also with IPNI, and we are a not-for-profit institute that's funded by primary producers of crop nutrients, and our mission is the responsible use of crop nutrients for the benefit of the human family. So one of the things that we've been working on for a number of years now has been this concept of 4R nutrient stewardship, and we worked with other organizations in coming up and promoting this concept. Worked with the International Fertilizer Association, the Fertilizer Institute, and Fertilizers Canada. And the 4R nutrient stewardship definition is application of the right source of nutrients at the right rate, time, and place for sustainable plant-based production systems. Now, this 4R nutrient stewardship has been great for communicating what the fertilizer industry is concerned about. As long as I've been with the Institute and its precursor, the Potash and Phosphate Institute, for the last 20 years, there are two questions that the fertilizer industry regularly asks, and I think has always asked. The first is, using the current terminology of the four R's, how right are we for any given nutrient management practice? And if we need to make some changes, how does that affect consumption? So those are the two questions I think that are a primary focus for the fertilizer industry. And I'll focus on some larger scope databases that we're using to try to come up with some metrics to answer these two questions for the industry. So when we think about 4R nutrient stewardship and some of the data requirements, one of the things that we're doing with 4Rs is the definition of right is always changing. It's because nutrient management is iterative. As we learn more, we have to revise our tools and revise the kinds of information that we're using in our decisions. So to kind of capture that iterative process, we have a diagram up here. The boxes in the middle represent kind of this linear process of discovery, starting with some sort of a decision support that can be some sort of a tool, whether it's something simple like a table or an equation or something as complex as a computer model that simulates crop growth. All of those things can go into producing and using information to come up with a recommendation. That recommendation, when you're talking with the person that's actually going to be applying the nutrients, that recommendation can be either accepted or rejected, or they could revise it. And based on that decision, there's some sort of action that takes place, and then the last box there is what happened. There was some sort of result, and that result needs to be compared to the desired outcome and how far from the result how far from the desired outcome is that result, and if there's a large disparity, then new information has to go into the decision support and revise that as well. So this is occurring at various levels, at the farm level, the regional level, the policy level, international level. So this is upscales fairly well, this kind of thought. But the main thing here that we're concerned about right now in this session is to come up with better evidence for that very first box. And I'll talk about some of the things that we're trying to do. So one of the things that the fertilizer industry has always been concerned about is how close are the yields that producers are getting to what's actually possible. And one of the things that is difficult to quantify is what is possible. So over the last several decades, actually, answering this question has become more accepted by scientists to use crop growth simulation models. So this is kind of epitomized here by this figure. This comes from the Yield Gap Atlas, which uses crop simulation modeling to come up with estimates of potential yield. Comparing that to farmer practice gives you a quantification of the gap, and that gap in this atlas is being mapped in various countries in the world. So to give you an idea of what kind of data requirements there are, this comes from some of the descriptions of what goes into that Yield Gap Atlas. But it starts out with looking at climate zones. Within each of those climate zones, you identify some reference weather stations, one or more, hopefully in each one of those zones. And the data requirements here are high-quality weather data that are taken at daily time steps. Those data are then combined with other genetic and environmental factors in the crop growth simulation model, and then there's a prediction of yield given for a buffer zone around those reference weather stations. Those are then upscaled by making some inferences, looking at commonalities in soil type or weather and those kinds of things, so that you can take individual simulation runs and upscale those to larger regions for estimates of potential yield. So the weather data are really critical in these simulations, and we became interested in trying to do something like this before the Yield Gap Atlas came out. We had worked for many years with Dr. Ken Kassman when he was with the International Rice Research Institute, as well as Achim Doberman. And the concept of ecological intensification was something that Dr. Ken Kassman had promoted for quite a while. And ecological intensification is a production system that satisfies the need for food, but also meets other outcomes that are desired by society, looking at providing other ecosystem services. So we were interested in how large the yield gap was in various regions in major maize growing areas. And so we set up an experiment with 20 different locations in those major maize growing areas around the world. And we asked scientists at those locations, could you come up with an ecological intensification treatment that would combine your knowledge about how best to manage maize to start closing that yield gap at a rate faster than farmers are currently doing? And we gave, we provided some funding for about 10 years at each location. One of the things that we had to think about early was how we allocate those dollars and what kind of measurements we take, and we decided that we couldn't afford the environmental measurements directly, and so we decided to focus on a proxy for those using nutrient use efficiency. Well, that project has produced mounds of data. And to gather those data, we used an Excel worksheet that was structured somewhat like a relational database. And so each tab, if you look at it in succession, was like another level in that relationship. So we ended up with 11 tabs in a workbook, and researchers will typically each year fill in 200 columns of data for us. And I think that has worked for those locations because we provide most of the funding at each of those sites. Where we do not provide funding, or we provide only a small portion of the funding, we have more difficulty gathering those data in those templates, as you might imagine. So is the template structure something that we would consider going forward? I'll visit about that a little bit more later. But what we typically have come around to now is, instead of providing a structured template, we're now more interested in just using the data structures that scientists already have, but providing some guidance on what measurements we'd like to see taken, but not being so strict about the data structure in which they're housed. We did a little temperature check on this project about 4 years in, and just to see what ecological intensification was doing. So we did a meta-analysis, and we found out that on average across all the site locations that we had and years at that point, that ecological intensification was increasing yield by about a ton of dry matter grain per hectare. However, the nitrogen use efficiency, which was our primary interest, we didn't see much change between ecological intensification and traditional farmer practice. In some cases it was worse, in some cases it was better, but on average there wasn't much difference. So we're thinking now, is this a reasonable expectation to be able to increase efficiency as well as increase yield? You think about a typical diminishing return curve, maybe it's not realistic. Are there some other metrics we may need to come up with in the future to try to estimate environmental impacts through something that we can measure fairly easily? Okay, so that is kind of answers this question about how do we create some metrics to get to the question that the fertilizer industry is interested in, and that is how close are we getting to the yields that are possible. So the next thing that we're wanting to address is another outcome that the industry is interested in, and that is, are nutrients being applied at rates that maintain soil fertility at optimum levels? So there's two pieces of this that are pretty critical to try to get right. And the first one is maintaining soil fertility. How do you tell if you're doing that? The second one is optimum level. What is the optimum soil test level to be managed at? And especially as you start aggregating across different areas. So those two metrics I'll talk about a little bit. But the whole idea is to try to come up to this kind of an assessment. So the first thing that we have is this nutrient use GIS. This is a tool that we developed in association with PAQ Interactive. It's an IT company that was very conversant in GIS and databases, relational databases, and tying those two together, as well as providing some web interfaces. But Nutrient Use GIS allows the user to go in and base, come up with a kind of a customized region and take a look at how removal to use is faring in, across these various scales. And so the metric that we're using for maintenance is looking at the amount of nutrients removed by crop harvest and comparing the amount of nutrients that are applied as fertilizer and manure. So that removal to use ratio, if it's about one, where you see the yellow areas, that indicates that, that those are approximately balanced. Where you see the red areas, it indicates that removal far exceeds application. And where you see the green areas, that's where removal is less than application. So that would be like an enrichment of fertility. So these kinds of metrics give us some idea of what's happening at larger scales with just a fairly simple nutrient budgeting approach. We don't consider other inputs beyond applications of fertilizer and manure, and we don't consider any other removals beyond crop removal. So it's kind of a, an easily measured, if you want to put it, way of evaluating that. The data sets that we use for this, there's four primary data sets, and they're at various different spatial scales, which creates problems when we're aggregating data. The first is looking at data from APCO, the American Association of Plant Food Control Officials. This is data that is reports fertilizer sales. We also looked at the Census of Agriculture as well as NAS data. And then for the estimates of removal, we relied on our own numbers. Our own removal numbers for that. When you start looking at some of the issues, I mentioned scale being an issue. Another one is that we looked at our own data, and we've known for years that we've had not a good paper trail on some of the nutrient uptake and removal numbers that we produce. And so we want to do a better job of making sure that we've got a transparent, repeatable process for coming up with these average values for nutrient uptake and removal. So to do that, we really are because we've done some forays into this already, we kind of see the way to go forward with this is with probably some meta-analyses and also systematic reviews. The systematic reviews will provide us with a priori criteria for selecting or rejecting studies to include in a quantitative assessment of the literature. And without that, we don't know why studies were included or not. And so we want to make sure we're trying to eliminate bias wherever we can see it. And so we'll use a systematic review to try to select those studies. Of those studies selected by the meta or by the systematic review, we'll use meta-analysis to try to quantify the average removal and uptake across those studies. One of the problems that we've had with this when we've looked at studies that qualify for the systematic review is that they don't qualify for a meta-analysis because certain things, particularly the variance, is not reported in a way that we can assimilate it into a meta-analysis. So this is an issue. To give you a little bit of a background, before we started this kind of thinking, we thought, well, let's just go to researchers directly and ask them for their data. And we worked with Dr. Manjula Nathan at University of Missouri, and she helped us do that. She made all the phone calls and emails and contacted researchers, all of whom she knew. And these are the kind of data that we produced from that survey work. The bold number is the average value, the number in square brackets is the standard deviation, and the number in parentheses is the N that produces those other two descriptive statistics. The states that are dark yellow are show the range in the mean value. This is for potassium, grams of K per kilogram dry matter. You can see it ranges from 3.1 in Wisconsin to 4.3 in, 3.1 in Michigan to 4.3 in Wisconsin and 3.1 in Colorado. The states that are white, Missouri and Louisiana, show you the range in standard deviation from 0.3 in Louisiana to 1.1 in Missouri. So we were hoping when we did this exercise that we would see some sort of obvious trend from east to west or from north to south, but we don't see anything like that. So we realized we're going to have to collect a lot more metadata than just location to try to understand why we're seeing these kinds of differences. But it was a good foray for us into these data to try to understand what we needed to do if we were going to be more rigorous. Okay, so that's how we're attacking the maintenance portion of the metric to come up with this outcome of trying to assess what nutrient use is for any given country or sub-area within a country. When we look at optimum levels, that's another part we're trying to attack. And one of the things that we're looking at is trying to understand if we can see what the trends are in the levels of nutrients in soils across time. One way that we've done this in North America, and this is now we're thinking about doing something similar because there's some data being collected like this in India right now, and also in Brazil. But we're thinking about trying to look at trends in these data over time. So we do a soil test summary that's conducted about every 4 or 5 years, and we ask laboratories to provide us with a number of samples testing in various soil test ranges. And so you can see across the x-axis at the bottom. And within each one of those ranges, you can see four bars. Those are each of the years that we've had in our survey that has used the same technique since 2001. And then the legend up at the top gives you some indication of the number of samples going into this particular assessment for this state, which is Nebraska. So in 2001, there were about 140 samples coming from Nebraska. By about 2015, we had over 500,000 samples coming in for this assessment. And you get some idea when you look at those bars that there's some sort of a trend in some categories. We looked at that statistically. We're working with Dr. Hao Zhang at Purdue University to help us come up with some techniques statistically to see if there were any significant differences here in changes over time. And of course, with these kinds of N values, everything's significant. So I don't know if that tells you anything either. But here we are. You can see that for those ranges that were greater than 320, we've seen almost a 15% reduction from 2001 to 2015 in the number of samples testing in that very high category. And you can see in the lower categories, we've seen increases. Now, the way that we interpret that is we think that soils that have been traditionally higher in Nebraska are now being drawn down. If you look at the average rate of fertilizer application in Nebraska, it's been about 5 kilograms of K per hectare. And you can tell that this is a naturally rich soil, so there's not much reason to apply K, not until you get below 120 part per million. And there's not many samples testing there, but there's a slight increase in those occurring over time. So are we at the optimum level in Nebraska? Well, if you look at the recommendations generated by the scientists in Nebraska, they say about 120 part per million is the critical level, where we define a critical level being the level below which a fertilizer application is recommended to attain the goals that particular recommendation wants you to get. So it's a bit fuzzy on that because the interpretations of soil tests vary from state to state. Some want you to build to a certain point beyond where you would get a crop response in the year of application. Some want you to manage at lower levels where you were insured a crop response with an application. So the critical level just simply for us is a way of marking the difference between a no application decision or a yes application decision. So one of the things that is striking about this is usually these critical levels for soil tests are static. They are developed through research trials in this particular state. Those are set, and those are published, and then no one can change those until more research comes through. The user, farmer or a crop consultant, cannot change or look at differences in that relationship at all. It's just you have those data as is. Australia is doing something a little different, and we're intrigued by this. Dr. Rob Norton, who's with our institute in Australia, has been working on this with many other scientists. He's been involved in that group. And this is funded by the Green Research and Development Center. And this is the BFDC interrogator, the Better Fertilizer Decisions for Crops interrogator. What this does is it is a relational database of fertilizer response trials over, I think it's about over 4,000 of these trials now for phosphorus and potassium. And a user can go in and select certain criteria to query this database. And so a user can look at, okay, I want to look at phosphorus, I want to look at a certain range in years, I want to look at a certain state, or I want to look at a certain season, and other criteria. And what this interface allows the user to do is to pick out these response trial data that match these criteria. Then the tool will plot those data that have been selected by the user, and they have an algorithm that will draw a response equation through that to come up with a critical level with a confidence interval around it. Right, so this is on the fly calculations based on queries of the data. So the idea here is, first of all, they've created a place where users can put in nutrient response trial data with common criteria for inclusion. You have to have certain metadata to include your data in this database. This database then grows over time, and as that grows over time, users can do more and more sophisticated queries and come up with meaningful relationships. So they can start looking at what the critical level should be in any given area. So this kind of gets to the question of, are we at optimum? And can we make that more flexible and more local? So the fertilizer industry itself, I have to say, is I've been impressed by their commitment to data, just data. They created a fund. The fertilizer industry came together as a group and generated $7 million of their own contributions to create this 4-hour research fund, which has been going on since 2014. And one of the key things that was a requirement, that all projects that were funded by the 4-hour fund had to put their data in a research repository and get a digital object identifier assigned. So Dr. Sylvie Brudere, who's also be speaking right after me, is spearheading that project at Purdue to facilitate that process with 4-hour fund researchers. And so kind of learning a little bit from the Global Maize template issue that we've had, here the requirement is not that you put your data in a certain template. The requirement is only that you have your own data structure, but it's well described and ready for publication, so that the third-party user can come in and know what your data are, know what each column is, and how those data were collected, and then they can use those for other purposes in the future. So, just to summarize, just a couple of points. Overall, fertilizer industry is interested ultimately in how these 4-hour decisions affect consumption. You can see some of the attempts that we're making at creating metrics to try to answer this question on various scales. And then finally, and then this is a point that Dr. Brulsma made in his earlier presentation earlier this summer, is that 4-hour nutrient stewardship really relies on data stewardship. Without good data stewardship, we will not be able to have the quality of 4-hour nutrient stewardship we would like to have in the future. So with that, I'll conclude. Thank you for your attention.
Got a hit. We've got time for a couple of questions, so if anybody has a question or two for Scott, we can take those now.
In Australia, when you have showing that was pretty cool, by the way, in Australia, when you have the responses for the phosphorus concentration, I mean, they're all the variables. Could you do that by soil type, or they just say, you know, the phosphorus concentration and the response, or do they have a query that you could query by sandy soil first or clay soil and then see that response or pH before you do that response?
Yeah, thank you for the question. The question is the slide that showed the BFDC interrogator and whether or not we could, whether a user can go in and select, for instance, a certain kind of soil and look at the response for that soil series. And they do have that ability to select a soil in that. Yeah, and so it might, I'm not sure about pH. I'd have to take a look. Yeah, the idea is that you eventually will be able to come up with very specific response curves, but a lot of times when you're looking at the queries, there may not be enough data yet, particularly for potassium. Their phosphorus data set's much more rich, but it takes more and more data to start making those more and more specific queries, as you're well aware.
One more question? Anyone? All right, let's give Scott a hand.